Okay, so today I'm here with David Gartenstein Ross. He can be found at DavidGR, and I'm with JM Berger, who can be found at IntelWire. And today we're talking about Al-Qaeda, and sort of our discussion is going to be limited, about Al-Qaeda from 2008 on. And and I think one of the key arguments that this sort of administration has put out is the idea that Al-Qaeda is weakened or on the run or on the verge of defeat. And so for today's show, we wanted to get David and JM to sort of to look at what the administration is saying and sort of compare it to their research, to facts, and to sort of, from there, sort of look at the counterterrorism policy and strategy that the Obama administration has been sort of engaging in, and sort of trying to understand whether, that counterterrorism policy and strategy is effective in sort of, attacking Al-Qaeda. So I want to start off with reading this quote. So this is Obama. This was part of one of Obama's speeches on September 12, 2012, in front. I think he was in Las Vegas, and he basically said, "A day after 9/11, we are reminded a new tower rises above New York, but Al-Qaeda is on the path to defeat, and Bin Laden is dead." So, what I'm taking from this speech and from this sort of snippet is that, Al-Qaeda is on the run and sort of, on sort of it's weakened, and it's definitely not the organization that we knew before 9/11. So I'm gonna go to David first, and does this, in terms of international effectiveness and international plots, does this sort of hold to your research and to sort of the facts you've been able to sort of bring up?
Well, let me throw a question back at you because I didn't quite hear when the quote was from. I know it was September 11th. Was it 2011 or 2012?
2012.
That's interesting, right? Because the previous day, you just had an attack. The administration hadn't yet called it a terrorist attack, but you just had an attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that ended up killing the ambassador. And within our discourse, this is something that is not referred to as an Al-Qaeda attack. So taking it at its most minimalist, one can say that it was an attack carried out by a jihadist group that shares Al-Qaeda's ideology. One of the big questions within this entire debate as to what is the state of Al-Qaeda is, what do you think of the Ansar al-Sharia groups, those in Libya, Tunisia, Egypt? In some cases, I think it's extraordinarily clear, just based on open source information, that one should consider them either within Al-Qaeda's orbit or else consider them Al-Qaeda. In other cases, it might not be as clear, but it's an interesting time to make that statement. I think that what the president is referring to, more than anything, is Al-Qaeda's core. But Al-Qaeda's core leadership doesn't make up the entirety of Al-Qaeda. When we talk about other groups that either A, share its ideology, or B, if given an order, would fall below the central leadership in the pecking order, and such would follow the advice that's given, I think that's a much larger group. When one looks at what the effect was of the Arab uprisings, those who can be classified as part of the Salafi jihadist movement, including those within Al-Qaeda, had a definite plan for what was going on, and it's not all about us. A lot of the focus is very much intensely upon the Arab world and post-transitional societies. They very much saw a plan to undertake dawah work where they couldn't do so before, that is missionary work, and they've been pursuing that pretty effectively. So when I look at the president's speech, I think that he does correctly describe that Al-Qaeda's central leadership has experienced a great deal of attrition, but I have questions about what that attrition means. We, functioning here in the open source, don't have very good visibility as to how many leaders remain. And when you look at the broader picture, not just of the central leadership, but of affiliates and fellow travelers that might be categorized as Al-Qaeda, it becomes much murkier and a much more difficult proposition to maintain the claims that the president is making.
Interesting. So, I mean, let's sort of complexify this then. I mean, how would you describe, you know, it? Let me ask this first. Is there a sort of centralized, you know, strategy among within Al-Qaeda and sort of these other jihadi groups? Or is this more sort of a, you know, a network of loosely affiliated organizations?
I will say yes, that there is a central strategy. It is not just a network of loosely affiliated organizations. If one goes back to the founding documents of Al-Qaeda and what we know about the early organizational structure, something which I know JM knows a lot about, there's no question that it was a highly bureaucratized organization prior to the 9/11 attacks. You know, the question that analysts have is what happened after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, after Al-Qaeda's central leadership relocated into Pakistan. And there, let me say that I think that the very limited release of documents based on what we got in Abbottabad is doing us a grave disservice. You know, it would be extremely helpful for those of us debating Al-Qaeda's organizational structure to have some information that gives us an indication of what that organizational structure was as of May 2011, the time that bin Laden was killed. If you look at the documents that were released, they don't do a whole lot. However, if you look at some of the more recent documents, such as those that were obtained in Mali, I would say that one can obtain a sense, based on open source material alone, that there is still an organizational structure. One can debate how strong that was, but we can discern things such as bin Laden's ability to get in touch with affiliates and in a very polite way to give orders about who they should host, who they should give money to. Second, we can discern that Zawahiri is able to be in touch also with affiliates as well. And also looking at documents that were produced around the time of the Arab uprisings, one can see from Zawahiri on down a staged plan, which included undertaking dawah work in societies where you could not do that before, and an envisioned eventual turn towards violence. If you look at the foundational work of Zawahiri and others, it's basically been followed. And one thing I should add, by the way, is that we know a lot more over the past 2 months than we did before about some of this foundational material based upon one thing. And that one thing is Sayyid al-Shihri, who was the deputy commander of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. After he was killed, it was revealed who he was online, you know, who he was posting as in the jihadi forums. By looking back at his material and people who were close to him, one can start to discern which of these online jihadists are actually rather important figures strategically. And I think that reassessment is going to, within the next several months, provide analysts a much deeper picture about what Al-Qaeda itself, and not just Salafi jihadi strategists, thought about the Arab uprisings and how they should respond.
So this is for JM. I mean, where do we put sort of the domestic and sort of not only the domestic sort of actors like Anwar al-Awlaki, but also the online? I mean, where do we sort of layer in, you know, American Muslims and sort of the online space into what David has sort of brought up and discussed?
Well, let me address the initial question and then hit that. So the question of, you know, what President Obama meant in 2012 when he made that statement goes to a fundamental problem that we have both in government, especially where it's especially acute, but even in academic circles, about how we define Al-Qaeda and what we mean when we say the words Al-Qaeda. And basically, you know, there are very limited, if you're looking at Al-Qaeda purely as the organization that attacked us on September 11th, I think you can certainly make a case, not a slam dunk case, but a case that that organization has largely been dismantled and is on its way to defeat as it was described. That said, and David's written about this at great length, and you know what we've seen instead is sort of the rise of the affiliates and the rise of a movement-based Al-Qaeda in addition to an organizational Al-Qaeda. And what I think is that when we look at how these affiliates and how the people beneath the affiliates are interacting with each other and interacting with the central Al-Qaeda that remains, what we're seeing is a lot of tensions that are really, we're kind of seeing a struggle for the ownership of this movement that's playing out relatively quickly, I think. So we know that Zawahiri has some ability and inclination to provide directions to the affiliates, but we also know that the affiliates don't always take his directions. We know that his directions sometimes come weeks or months after the events that he's addressing have already played out. We're seeing a lot of fraying around the edges. And, you know, if depending on how one reads the report of this Al-Qaeda conference call that prompted the recent terror alert, you can argue that Zawahiri is aware of the fact that his kind of slow motion management of this organization is starting to fail him and is willing to take more operational risks to be more directly involved. So where online enters into this, I think, is that it's provided something that jihadis really haven't had before, which is a large public forum in which strong ideas can rise and weak ideas can be shut down through, you know, basically crowdsourcing, democratic process of a sort. And what you're seeing, I think, is that there's a lot of emerging ideas that are really viably competing for the jihadi trend. And I think that there's, you know, I think we're starting to see the seeds of a possible, you know, avenue whereby the jihadi trend could split from Al-Qaeda movement. And I think there's a lot of interesting implications to that. And I think what social media is doing is in part, it's just making visible discussions that happened before, but it's also opening those discussions to anybody who wants to participate. And when that happens, individuals are able to sort of rise up and play an influential role in this that we haven't seen before. So I think, to my mind, we're seeing a situation where there's a real hothouse kind of effect going on that is accelerating changes in this movement. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of different directions it could go from here. I think it's a pretty interesting time to be watching these guys.
Could I jump in here? Because Jam and I see part of this a little bit differently. Let me first say that I find that Jam's work on how the online environment is shifting the course of jihadism and leadership to be very interesting. It makes some very relevant points. But when you talk about the struggle for ownership, struggle for leadership within Al-Qaeda, and how affiliates don't always go along, I assume that what you're referring to is the attempted merger between Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, correct?
Not just that, but yes.
Well, what
that.
Else are you referring to?
I'm also referring to al-Shabaab.
What aspect of Shabaab?
The aspect whereby people with longstanding ties to al-Qaeda have been marginalized or killed and have tried to take to social media in order to sway opinion and to get Zawahiri's attention. There's also some stuff that's happened on the forums in terms of some of the more prominent guys, most notably Strategy Affairs, really stepping out of the forum power structure and becoming a force on his own and providing dissent and sowing dissent. And that in particular was over the ISI merger. But I mean, I think that there's really, he in particular shows a power base that's kind of rising up in this movement and represents an alternative to the organizational model.
Now, ultimately, like the difference in these two views, you know, one that is central leadership structure centered versus one that's more diffuse, actually has profound implications. I think this is very important, and so I think it's very good that you have these two views right here on the podcast. And I'll say that most analysts would fall in JM's camp. Most analysts say that we're moving towards increasingly decentralized Salafi jihadism, that central leadership is eroding. I would question that. And I think particularly, let me say, I think JM would agree with me on this point, that it's very important for us to consider alternative hypotheses for what's going on in the world of jihadism, because so much of what we're trying to analyze is stuff that we can't see. You know, there's a lot of assertions made by many analysts on many different sides of the coin about whether central leadership matters, whether there's command and control, whether X affiliate is talking to Y affiliate. And at the end of the day, we don't know a lot of these answers. Sometimes we have data points, but what we have is only a fraction of the whole. So moving to this, I see these data points a bit differently. There's always been tension amongst affiliates. Often, degrees of authority aren't as clear and delineated as they could be. And the ISIS and Nusra, the attempted merger and the aftermath, is something that's very interesting because that was indeed challenged as Zawahiri's authority. Now, the question is, to me, what happens next? We know for a fact that Nusra and ISIS are currently in talks. There's attempts at remediation. This may, in this particular instance, end up reasserting central leadership's authority. It may not. But one thing that we can see is when on an ISIS forum, you had members bad-mouthing Zawahiri. ISIS's leadership very quickly struck that down and condemned these attacks on Zawahiri, which is interesting in the context of the overall relationship. For the Shabab stuff, I don't quite agree with JM. The reference there is Hamami and others who were tied to al-Qaeda, but this I see as a much more internal thing. Ghadani himself is very much al-Qaeda tied. I am not sure that these tensions within Somalia and within Shabab are indicative of a leadership structure that's fraying as much as they're in line with the inevitable armed violent struggles that arise within a violent and armed organization. But anyway, these are two different views. And I think that more than anything, understanding the range of what might be possible and what might be going on is very important, because I don't think I think very few analysts actually had a crystal ball.
I mean, I agree that a lot of what, we're working on partial information. So, a lot of the time we are engaging in speculation of various amounts of informed speculation. As far as, for instance, the organizational al-Qaeda, we can't see the whole iceberg, but what we see is when a plot, specific intelligence is found, we're seeing stuff that kind of reflects a different structure. As far as what you bring up on the ISIS forum, I mean, one thing that I think is a critical transition that's happening right now is that the forums have always been a authoritative structure. So they're a structure for maintaining order and discipline, message discipline, and until fairly recently, they were very good at that. So when Hamami first launched his protest, just to pick the one that I'm most familiar with, he didn't get anywhere for a long time because the forums ruthlessly suppressed everything that he was trying to get out there. What we're seeing now is really, and this is in the last year especially, it's accelerated, but we're seeing a very widespread adoption of social media as an alternative to the forums. So Strategy Affairs is Abdullah bin Don. I think I may have got that name, Abdullah bin Muhammad. But he's a figure who was very prominent on the forums. He was an important figure on al-Qaeda-linked forums. And he, because he was promulgating a conspiracy theory about the Islamic State of Iraq, he was banished from the forums. And what he now is able to do is exert a lot of influence on the movement from outside, from the social media perspective. We're seeing a really big, and when I say we're seeing a big adoption of social media, I don't mean just, jihadists moving from one to the other. We're seeing foreign fighters, I mean actual on-the-ground foreign fighters and terrorists who are on social media doing operational stuff. So, I mean, when these conversations happen and these competing polls emerge, it's not just the stay-at-home guys. It's the actual figures.
No, I understand that and I agree with it. And as I said, I find your work in this regard very interesting, and I have learned from it. The kind of warning that I'll have about conclusions one might draw from it is, foreign fighters are certainly operational, but how important are they to an organization? When one looks at, social media and forums, who is dominating the discussions? and who's dominating the people who are actually important to the organization. So, for example, one thing that's very interesting, I mentioned before Saeed Asshikri's death, and you know, I wrote a piece for Foreign Policy called The Cuban in the Desert, which looks at his online postings. His online postings, when he was anonymous, were very prominently displayed. They, you know, such that they gave people an indication that he was probably important. Likewise, there are several other figures on the forums who I believe to actually be rather high level in al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And the forums, in my view, are still very much slanted towards them. You also have a second thing, which is, you know, a system of bayat, or loyalty, within the organization. Now, not everybody who is either operational or obviously a jihadist, not all of them have taken bayat or have a specific loyalty to specific leaders. But there may be a more tight level of control internally than social media leaves us to believe. But as I said, I think that JM's work is very interesting, in part because social media is, of course, in fact, changing the dynamic of discourse. Unless one takes into account that there may be more going on, it may be easy to overread what the effect is.
Well, I'm definitely not assuming that what I see on social media is the only thing that's going on. But what I do try and do, and where most of my efforts in analyzing this stuff these days falls, is correlating events and people to stuff that happens in real life that is reported in other forums, whether it's on the jihadi forums, whether it's in the mainstream news, and trying to use this stuff to get a picture of on the ground realities rather than just be interested in the online dynamics, which are interesting. When you bring up about foreign fighters and their importance to the organization, I think that that's, to me, that's really the crux of what's happening in terms of the internal tensions with the al-Qaeda movement at this point. So I think that there's a growing, if you look at Afghanistan, so we had Afghanistan, we had in the Soviet days, and we had the rise of the foreign fighters. Al-Qaeda took that movement and tried to shift it into, create a sense of continuity that said, this goes into terrorism. This, we move from this into a terrorist, a kind of operational basis. And, you know, you can see sort of in Bosnia the first hints of what we're seeing more now, which is that the foreign fighter networks stand aside from al-Qaeda to a certain extent. Al-Qaeda's there, it's working inside them, mixing it up, influencing them, but it's not running the foreign fighters in Bosnia. So when, after September 11th, because of, I think, you know, in large part, I would point to our invasion of Iraq as being a factor in this, al-Qaeda and foreign fighter activity kind of started to conflate again. Never perfectly. There's like a huge diverse kind of, there's always this kind of factional competition and stuff going on. But the sort of umbrella and ideology and iconography of al-Qaeda starts to spread over the foreign fighter movements. And what we're seeing now, I think, is a real tension whereby there's interest in a lot of people in the Muslim world in a jihadi trend that does not necessarily include terrorism and al-Qaeda's formulation of what jihad looks like. And, you know, when we were talking earlier about the Ansar al-Sharia's, you know, and I agree, they're different in different places. So in Yemen, it's more of a extension or a cover on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as much as I can tell. I'm not a Yemen expert. Yeah. In other countries, it's more of a attempt to create a jihadist movement that isn't just about fighting. Just about fighting. So when AQAP, if you look at the letter that was recently exposed from Wuhashi to AQIM, there's a real cynicism when he talks about providing services to local people. It's like, you know, let's give them the conveniences of life so that they will be more inclined to support us. Whereas I think in other countries, and I would say Tunisia looks to me, and again, I'm not an expert in Tunisia, but it looks to me like there's a more sincere effort to try and build a structure of society there within the Salafi jihadist trend. And al-Qaeda's ideology, increasingly, it seems to me, the distinguishing factor is really its use of violence, even above and beyond its actual goals. The thing that makes it what it is its commitment to violence into violence until the day of judgment, regardless of whether you're winning, whether you're losing, whether you're holding ground, whether you're losing ground. And I think there's some pushback happening on that. And Syria is kind of a laboratory where a lot of this stuff is playing out, and it's interesting watching it, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Well, I think that what you raised, Jim, is really the crux of the issue, which is how do we understand the Ansar al-Sharia groups? I mean, I think you'd agree that is kind of critical. Is it post-Al-Qaeda jihadism, or is it Al-Qaeda rebranded? And we both agree that in Yemen, it's AQ rebranded. You pointed to Tunisia as a place where they might be less cynical about the use of social services than, for example, they are in Yemen. Having done field research in Tunisia, I don't agree with that. If you look at the provision of social services, it's a very sporadic thing. Social media makes it look like it's happening constantly, and it is, but they're not servicing the same communities. There's not social services that are going to the same people week after week, such that it's actually making a week-after-week difference in their lives. Rather, you have essentially social service being diffused throughout the country, and it'll go right away up on social media, look at all this good stuff that we're doing, and then they won't go back to the community again for a while. What that indicates to me is that this is really very PR-based. Now, if you look at the leadership, let's take two different Ansar al-Sharia groups. Let's take Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia and Ansar al-Sharia in Egypt. The leadership in both levels, when one looks at them, they look like Al-Qaeda, they have relations that look like Al-Qaeda, and they have an ideology that looks like Al-Qaeda. So Abu Yahya al-Tanisi, he's a longtime Al-Qaeda confederate, going all the way back to being a part of the plot to assassinate Massoud on the eve of the Afghan, of the 9/11 attacks. Thereafter, you have a number of AST associates who were involved in Al-Qaeda's European network. Eventually, Abu Yad was picked up in Turkey. Likewise, in Egypt, if you go back to the guys who are part of the core of Ansar al-Sharia in Egypt, these are guys who, you know, 10, 12 years ago, were considered part of core Al-Qaeda. If you look at, for example, Mark Sageman's book, Understanding Terror Networks, which in the back has an appendix which lists who can be considered part of Al-Qaeda's core, it has guys who are part of the core and who have relationships with Zawahiri going back to before Zawahiri was considered Al-Qaeda. So if you go back and look at figures like Ahmed Ashush other guys, you know, Muhammad al-Zawahiri is a part of the Ansar al-Sharia organization there. They have long-standing relationships with this form of jihadism and also with specifically the emir of Al-Qaeda. So there's also data points that support the view that this is a rebranding, but it's one that actually isn't organizationally separate from Al-Qaeda. And if that's correct, if that view is correct, then we're not actually seeing a decentralization of jihadism. Rather, what we're seeing is a rebranding of jihadism. Anyway, these are the two dominant views. These are the two competing views. And I think understanding the contours of these two competing views is very important. Because at the end of the day, you know, look, at the end of the day, it may be that the truth is somewhere in the middle. But these are, I think, the two best interpretations of what may be going on. And I think that there's evidence to support both of them in the open source.
I would agree with that. I would point out what I would say, you know, as far as there's sort of the visible and the invisible parts of what's happening in these different organizations. So, but, you know, there's also the well-known expression is fake it until you make it. So what you're seeing and what I see when I look at online conversations in particular, and that's obviously skewed toward that arena, but when you see people who are interested in these movements, interested in jihadist movements, interested in Al-Qaeda, they're responding, people who are either being recruited or who are newly recruited or who are, you know, on the ground in some capacity as a foreign fighter somewhere. And what you're seeing is, I think that they're enamored of this model whereby the organization acts more like a traditional political movement. And to me, if you look at the fundamental flaw in how Al-Qaeda operates as a movement, it's unconcerned with political goals. So it has political goals, but ultimately it is more concerned with fighting than it is with winning. They care more about fighting than they do about winning or about building. And I don't think that's sustainable. And I think we're seeing, you know, and I think, you know, if whether you see the Ansar al-Sharia as a honest movement doing what they look like they're doing, or whether you see it as al-Qaeda repositioning, it's creating interest in this approach in becoming more of a traditional political movement and less, of a traditional militant.
I think you need to be more specific in your language, though, because I don't think you mean what you're saying. And correct me if I'm wrong. But when one talks about a political movement, one thinks of a movement that participates in the political system. If one looks at these various Ansar al-Sharia groups from Libya to Tunisia to Egypt, none of them are participating in the political system. What they are doing is dawah work or mission work. They're basically working from the ground up, similar to, you know, the early brotherhood under Hassan al-Banna. And I think that's what you're talking about, it's a social movement, not necessarily a political movement that participates in the political system. Would you agree with that framing of your words?
When I say a political movement, I mean a movement that has political goals it is working to achieve. So white supremacists, for instance, many of them, whether they're neo-Nazis or whether they're white separatists in the Northwest movement, they have articulatable political goals, and their actions are intended to achieve those goals. Whereas al-Qaeda has a stated political vision of the future, but its actions are not visibly in support of those goals. That really it's just like a continual lashing out on the assumption that either the day of judgment will come or somehow magically the caliphate will rise. And so, you know, when I look at how, you know, the thing that we distinguish as al-Qaeda in these movements, what I see is really a very nihilistic approach to strategy and to politics. And I think the Ansars, in contrast, recognize the importance of at least trying to show that you can build something and trying to show that you can do something other than fight. And that, to me, is sort of a fracture line that really is very interesting in watching it play out.
I personally wouldn't use the word political there for one reason, which is that when people hear political, they think groups that are going to participate in the political system. I agree with much of what you're saying. I think that what we see is a burgeoning social movement that at this point embraces nonviolence, although at the same time, certainly in Tunisia, the leadership of Ansar al-Sharia has talked about how at some point they will transition from a nonviolent dawah-based approach to a more violent approach. In Egypt, they already, to me, very clearly have embraced a violent approach. When one traces the violence that's occurring in Sinai after Morsi being deposed. But in terms of strategy, JM, I think we see things a little bit differently. I see al-Qaeda not as being nihilistic when it comes to strategy. I see them as actually having pretty defined strategy with one rather fatal flaw, which is when it comes to governance, they're awful. I think that they've done a very good job getting up to the point where they govern. They came to govern very distinct geographic areas in Somalia, in Yemen, in Mali. And you can see adaptations each time. They do things a little bit better, they're a little bit softer, but at the end of the day, they have major problems because they're much more focused, as JM says, on fighting their foes and winning, as well as the implementation of a fairly hardline version of Sharia, than they are on things like how to pick up the trash and, you know, how to make sure you have mail that's delivered on time and the kind of normal things that people expect of a state. Further, their very hardline version of Sharia definitely serves at cross purposes to what they're trying to accomplish. So in Somalia, one of the biggest mistakes that Shabaab made was kicking out the various aid organizations from areas that it controlled, arguing that those aid organizations were promoting both secularism and Christianity. As a result, if one looks at a couple years back when a massive drought hit the Horn of Africa, the areas where that drought deepened to famine were areas that Shabaab controlled. And people in those areas damn well remember what Shabaab inflicted upon them, which goes to the fact that these organizations ultimately are very ideological, and that both gives them life, but it's also a constant thorn in their side, which makes it very difficult for them to achieve their goals.
When I say, you know, just when I'm talking about al-Qaeda not being strategic, I mean, I think it's not strategic in terms of building. It's strategic in terms of the use of violence. And I would, something that I would, you know, make a distinction on, and maybe this is a subtle, badly defined distinction, but I would distinguish between the use of violence and the use of force. So Al-Qaeda, you know, increasingly conveys itself as kind of a cult of violence that is, you know, really kind of focused on the acts of killing and glorifying the acts of killing, whereas it's not about the use of force in the way that a state or a functioning society uses force. I mean, all societies have a component of force, of violence or force in their system. You've got police, you've got militaries. The difference is that, you know, I think that when you look at the sort of the things that distinguish Al-Qaeda, and much of my thinking on this is skewed perhaps disproportionately by having spent a lot of time with The Constants on the Path of Jihad, which is the Yusuf al-Urari piece that Anwar al-Awlaki translated. And really, you know, there's an elevation of killing and violent activity that is not the same as the judicious use of force. So Al-Qaeda can do things that are, can have strategic goals that, that it can accomplish. Those goals usually pertain to the perpetuation of fighting, instead of to, you know, the building of societies. So, and I think that it seems to me both that there's an internal tension that's happening on this, but I think that it also is something that we, as in the West and in countering violent extremism kind of initiatives, I think that there's room for us to work in there in terms of talking to people about what it is they really want to accomplish and whether it's, you know, just killing and martyrdom or whether they really want to make the world a better place for Muslims, which I think a lot of them do.
Right. I mean, I think we're in basic agreement. The only thing I'd caution is that Al-Qaeda and, you know, its fellow travelers, you know, Al-Qaeda is a learning organization, and its fellow travelers are also capable of learning. And one thing that we can see is that the AQ-affiliated groups in Syria have been, you know, very effective at setting up dawah, like fun days for kids, and, you know, propagandizing about their good intentions, as well as capturing territory and running it like a state. Now, again, I'm not saying that they're going to be successful in doing so. I think that they have some significant disadvantages, which are rooted in their ideology and rooted in their emphasis on fighting over governing. But I do think that it's good to always regard them as a learning organization and see if there are areas where they're making adaptations that can serve to their strategic advantage.
I agree with that. And I mean, the only thing that I guess where things get difficult and complicated, and this is a sort of broad policy problem for us in terms of how we approach this, is being able to make some kind of determination about where there's the potential for these guys to evolve in a positive way. And, you know, and it's extraordinarily difficult. And you see this reflected over the whole spectrum of discussion about Islamism, really, is, you know, when is it our role to attack and treat somebody as a military adversary or a diplomatic enemy, and when is it in our interest to keep hands off for the most part? I mean, there's rare that we're going to really do anything that's supportive of one of these movements, but you know, certainly in Egypt, we were content to let the Muslim Brotherhood have their moment, and I think many people in and out of government are not happy about how the Muslim Brotherhood lost that moment, so...
Well, I think when one looks for schisms, let me point to one very clear weakness in Al-Qaeda groups, which is that when they give interviews, they don't actually let the interviewer ask any questions. That's a huge weakness.
I declare jihad on that statement.
Well, I mean, let's... I want to sort of... sort of, you described the organization very well, both of you have. I want to move on to the question of a model of leadership, in the sense that, you know, I think when Anwar al-Awlaki was alive, and even after he was killed or drone struck or whatever, you know, I think the debate with him was, you know, that he would become the leader, the next Bin Laden, I think was the popular meme at the time. So I'm sort of curious if we could sort of discuss comparing Anwar al-Awlaki and Bin Laden as a sort of a model of leadership. And to sort of clarify, what I mean is sort of Anwar al-Awlaki, you know, for the audience, he used YouTube, blogs, and was very much an online presence and was able to influence and radicalize people through the online sort of space. Whereas Bin Laden was, you know, had gone to war in Afghanistan, had millions of dollars, and knew how to sort of organize people like you would, you know, like a manager, like in an office. And I'm sort of curious, you know, going forward, I mean, what is the model of leadership that we should expect from core al-Qaeda and these jihadi networks? I mean, is something similar to Anwar al-Awlaki going to be sort of, you know, what we should expect, or should we expect sort of something similar to Bin Laden, you know, something like a combat hardened, you know, guy with a lot of organizational and money skills?
Well, I know that JM always bristled at the next Bin Laden comparisons that were made about al-Awlaki, and I fully agree with him on this point. In part, they're just such different individuals. For one thing, Bin Laden actually was the leader of al-Qaeda, whereas al-Awlaki wasn't even the leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. He was he did head up their external operations, but he did not head the entire organization. And I think that basically both will coexist. And to me, it's not so much the battle-hardened aspect of Bin Laden, as much as, you know, he spoke sparingly. His public messages were infrequent but designed to have an impact. I think Zawahiri is doing something similar, although not as effectively, and with a little bit more of a constant flow of material, which is consonant with Zawahiri's personality. But a lot of the organizational stuff, what's happening inside of AQ, the organization, is something we don't have good visibility on. And that's very clear from the fact that JM and I have some fundamental disagreements about what we think is going on, and neither of us can really prove the other one wrong. I mean, we have hypotheses, we have evidence, but you know, it opens itself up to more than one interpretation. But if you look within, if you take out al-Awlaki, and you look within al-Qaeda, the organization, you had other figures who were al-Awlaki-like in terms of, you know, much more constant videos, being more active. I would say that Abu Yahya al-Libi, you know, kind of a dashing figure, one who did have combat experience, by the way, was a little bit more in the al-Awlaki mode than the Bin Laden mode. And we'll see more figures who are like that. In fact, I think we will also see more figures who are somewhat active on social media, although I think it's much more likely that they will use aliases on social media. The reason why is because, you know, if you have Abu Yahya al-Libi posting openly on Twitter or, you know, with his own Facebook account, that eventually is going to be used to target him. That's why, for example, within ACAP, ACAP leaders who have been active on social media have not revealed their identities, in part, in my view, because of operational security concerns.
So there's always been both types of guys in al-Qaeda and in the broader movement. There have always been the generals, which is how I would characterize Bin Laden, as a commander, and there have always been the clerics who provide support. And al-Awlaki did, you know, from all indications, did overlap those roles a little bit, but really there were two things that made al-Awlaki unique or apparently unique. One is that he was just really gifted orator. He's really gifted speaker. He was really gifted at argumentation, and, you know, he was effective in that and popular. The other is the status accorded to him by the American government in terms of how they discussed him as a threat, in terms of the strategies they were willing to entertain to use against him. And that, I think, the perception of al-Awlaki as a important top leader in al-Qaeda kind of proceeds from how the government treated him rather than necessarily from how what we see about him. And I want to qualify that by saying that, I mean, people I trust who have access to information that they can't share with me say that Alwaki's, you know, operational role was more significant than what it seems to be from the outside. I mean, people I trust sufficiently to make this qualification, because generally speaking, it seems to me that the evidence very strongly points in the other direction. So, as we have frequently done in this conversation, I qualify it with the things that we don't know. But, I think that Alwaki just happened to be, you know, part of the reason that he became so successful is partly due to his own merits, and partly it was due to the novelty of an American speaking perfect colloquial English who could give these messages effectively, which we haven't seen too many figures like that. Alwaki is certainly not the only one, but he was by far the most effective one.
Right. And to add something very quick, I mentioned Abu Yahya al-Libi. Al-Libi was working in Arabic, and I compared him to Alaki. I think that he had the same sort of gifts that JM puts forward for Alaki. It's just, you know, his focus was on an Arabic-speaking audience, whereas Alaki was very influential in an English-speaking audience.
I was actually the first person to say Yahya al-Libi was the next bin Laden. I coined the phrase the next bin Laden off of that. Way, way back. I regret it now, but but at the time it seemed like a good idea.
I mean, let me ask it the question this way. Is there even the possibility of a next bin Laden? I mean, it seems like the networks you guys sort of highlighted and described are so nebulous and decentralized. It seems like to have a quote general, somebody who is a commander over a centralized network, doesn't even seem possible. That really, it's either you have a lot of colonels and a lot of lieutenants, or, you know, you really just have, you know, just a bunch of, you know, really just, you know, self-motivated individuals running around with a particular ideology. I mean, within what you've described, is there even a possibility of a next general or, you know, a next, you know, big, you know, well-known leader?
For what I describe, absolutely. I mean, this comes down to the difference in how JM and I think Al-Qaeda is functioning. I see it as much less decentralized and much less nebulous than other analysts do. If someone thinks it's decentralized and nebulous, then, you know, it might be impossible. But what I would state is, you know, what is needed for core leadership? I mean, that's the question. What is needed for core leadership? When Zawahiri ended up taking the reins, you know, all the major figures who mattered ended up pledging bayat to him and acknowledging him as the new emir of Al-Qaeda. I mean, do you need, do you need to have a certain personality? Do you need to have a certain access to the internet so that you can be posting constantly? Do you need to have, you know, a certain network of couriers? I would ask then, you know, if one thinks that Al-Qaeda is very decentralized, what is it that Zawahiri lacks? I mean, part of it could be, in an analyst's view, that there are schisms within the organization that didn't exist before. Maybe they think that he doesn't have the same sort of relationships, although in some theaters that would be difficult to maintain, because in Egypt, for example, he certainly has better relationships than bin Laden did with the key players. So it's not at all clear to me, even if one accepts a decentralized view, that another bin Laden figure operating in a similar manner as their 4 or 5-star general couldn't happen again.
I think that, you know, when we talk about the next bin Laden, I mean, certainly there are going to be, as long as the organizational model is still clinging on by its fingernails, which I think we agree it is at least doing that, there's always going to be generals. The question is whether you're going to have an effective figure like bin Laden. Bin Laden walked into this movement with a lot of advantages, including a gigantic amount of money and a popular movement that had just come off of a relatively completed conflict. And he was able to work quietly under the radar to build an organization without getting a lot of attention from intelligence services and military. Whoever leads Al-Qaeda in the future is not going to have any of those advantages, so they're going to have to find other ones. And, you know, there are, it's certainly, I can imagine ways that somebody could emerge as a powerful figure in the movement like that. But I think that it's going to be much more difficult going forward because, you know, you're not going to be able to hit the ground running in the way that Bin Laden did.
So I want to sort of switch our discussion over from terrorism to counterterrorism. And I think this is something that it's discussed, but it's not really, I want to sort of get your guys' thoughts on it. And what, you know, I'm sort of defining as counterterrorism, at least as far as the Obama administration is concerned, is sort of the use of signature and targeted strikes, you know, and sort of the recent leaks, on the metadata program, metadata, Verizon order, the whole sort of batch of NSA leaks. You know, my first question is, you know, is that an accurate description of the Obama administration's counterterrorism policy? And then part of that is that effective? You know, has it been able to degrade and sort of stop, I guess that'll be the verb I use, you know, Al-Qaeda, core Al-Qaeda, and these other affiliated networks?
Jim, are you going to let me take this one?
I have many thoughts on it. I'm happy to go first if you want. I think, you know, this is a question for David in many ways, because I think one of the things that really comes down to is that, you know, nobody disputes that all of these tactics taken in whole, in addition to other ones, I'm reading right now Enemies Within, the new book by Matt Apuzzo and Adam Goldman, on the NYPD's counterterrorism efforts. And basically, there's no question that these tactics are able to hurt and degrade Al-Qaeda and contribute to preventing terrorist attacks. There are significant questions about the costs, both, and I'm talking not just the financial costs, although that is a huge component of this, but there's also a societal cost to, you know, having a running governmental systems that are seen as highly intrusive and not having legal backstops. And I think that, you know, we are going to have to realign these things, and I think it would be better if we started doing it in a measured, thoughtful way than to have it just collapse under a pile of scandals and investigative reports. I don't have confidence that our government is capable of taking the measured approach, so maybe we'll be going the other way, but I think there's going to have to be some realignment of this at some point.
So to take it, I'm not going to delve in too deeply on these because we've been talking for a while and I don't want to exhaust the audience. But what I'll say is I think Gregory Johnson has raised a number of very good critiques of the use of signature strikes in Yemen. On the question of whether drone strikes are good, I think that our debate in the public sphere is so sloppy, like so sloppy. We debate drone strikes as though they're all the same. Whereas, you know, it really depends upon, A, the theater in which any given drone strike occurs, and, B, it often depends on the specifics of the drone strike itself. So I wouldn't draw a generality there, except to say I do think that we, in places like Yemen, have clearly overused this tactic in a way that, in my view, is not particularly strategic because we're not thinking about how the organization degrades. So we think, you know, more bodies equals more success. And I think that that's very problematic. And I agree with what Jam says about the rest, that we need to think about sustainability of these efforts, in essence. But when I look at the Obama administration's policies, you know, I would define them by, A, drone strikes, as you say. I wouldn't really define them by, you know, NSA surveillance, because that's something that predated Obama, that he hasn't really done much to change. It was a course that was set previously, and a course that I think was set rather naturally, whatever one may think of it. A lot of things kind of lined up, and we got to the situation we were in. But one final thing I'll say is that I think another thing that at the end of the day, when we look back on this era, is going to define the Obama administration's approach, is its approach to the Arab Spring. Because I think that the Arab uprisings are having a tremendous organizational impact on Al-Qaeda, and hence a tremendous organizational impact on our counterterrorism efforts. And one thing that people will look back to is the intervention in Libya, which I believe had second-order consequences that were extremely helpful to the forces of jihadism. Now, one can dispute that. I mean, people get into plenty of debates, and it's too early to assess. I will fully grant that. But I think if you look at second-order consequences of the Libya intervention in places like Mali, in places like Egypt, and also, in my view, in Syria, it really hastened a lot of events that came afterwards without us getting a chance to have a handle on them. And the other thing that I think will characterize this is a certain conception of al-Qaeda, in which, as you said at the beginning of the show, al-Qaeda is on the ropes, al-Qaeda is almost dead, al-Qaeda has very little of an organizational structure. And, you know, at the end of the day, if those prove to be right, then, you know, my critiques of the administration will look rather foolish, and people can point at me and laugh for being wrong about this big issue. If the administration is wrong, then it's going to look very, very bad for being so invested in a particular view of al-Qaeda and adjusting its strategy accordingly. So a lot rides on that conception that we began this show with.
And I would just say, you know, in addition to the Libya intervention, this is not so much the Obama administration, obviously, but I mean, when we talk about second order consequences of intervention generally, and when we look at Libya, when we look at the discussion about Syria right now, I think we have to look at Iraq, and we have to say, what were the second order consequences of our intervention there? Because increasingly, you know, you can see cause and effect are always tricky, even when you're doing it after the fact, but you can certainly see how the stage was set for Syria based on our presence in Iraq. And, you know, I think this goes to sort of the broader question of intervention, which is really the thing that's, you know, everybody's talking about this week. So,
you know, before we end the show, as with every show, we always ask the guests, you know, a last word. Did we miss anything? I don't think we missed anything in our conversation. But I mean, we always like to ask, you know, ask the guests for a last word or sort of a last comment for the audience to chew on and think about. I guess, David, you can go first, I suppose.
Well, my last word would be this. You know, I thought this was a very good civil discussion. You know, I have the utmost respect for JM. I know that it's mutual, in which we presented two very different views of what we think is going on within the world of jihadism. And now, let me say, there's actually a lot of overlap between our views. We've been emphasizing differences as opposed to commonalities, and that's good because, you know, this is, after all, a podcast, and podcasts are really boring if we just sit around agreeing with each other. But I think it was great that we were able to draw these out, and one could see the evidence that that one could point to for either of these positions. One enormous problem that I have over since the beginning of the Arab Spring with analysis on this issue is that there has been, in my view, a lot of squelching of dissenting opinions on what the impact of the Arab Spring was going to be and what the impact and what al-Qaeda's organizational structure is. You know, given the how little we know about these organizations, one has to be open to alternative hypotheses. I think that's extremely important, to question what you know, how you know it. At the end of the day, we're depending upon very little evidence. And if you look back at a lot of the very bold proclamations that were made, like the bold proclamations just after the Arab Spring began, that this had definitively killed al-Qaeda, or other, you know, bold proclamations, a lot of them look like no more than astrology, essentially. Someone saying something very definitive about the world and not actually having a basis for it. So, number one, I think exchanges like this are very important, where we can put forward differing views and the evidence behind them. And, you know, look, if it were just Jim and I think we could get into a much more in-depth, detailed, and frankly boring to listeners discussion, but one that both of us would enjoy much more. I think that process of looking at other ideas about what may be happening is what analysts need so that we do not descend into merely being astrologers.
I definitely want to echo David's comments, and I mean, I think that, you know, frankly, there's really a need for people with differing opinions to be able to express them in more constructive ways than a lot of what we see going on right now. And there's just, you know, it's this kind of, you know, the back and forth and the challenge and the informing of each other's opinions is important to us sort of evolving where we go from here. And, you know, I think that in many ways we're, you know, our two arguments are proceeding from basically the same world, the same operating world, the same set of facts, you know, with the, some of the crucial distinctions coming into places where we don't know stuff. And everything, you know, that we've talked about here is really part of an evolving understanding of a movement that is evolving while we're understanding it. And I think that, to me, you know, the focus going forward and increasingly is that as a government, as a policy-making organization, the United States and its allies need to define their interests and concerns and their perception of what Al-Qaeda is, how they are going to define Al-Qaeda for policy purposes, because otherwise we're just moving into increasingly murky policy decisions that are really ultimately ad hoc. So the decision whether we're going to intervene in Syria, you know, is coming down to, once again, you know, a media story, and how big is it playing in the media, and how much media pressure is there to intervene. And, you know, what I would prefer to see is for us to really just tackle these problems from in a really kind of systematic way, from starting with making definitions of what Al-Qaeda is, what our policy authorizes us to do if something is determined to fit the definition of Al-Qaeda, and how our national interests are served by different kinds of actions, both in the service of, you know, sort of the broad political sphere of the world in terms of preventing atrocities, and also in terms of how we deploy the weapons of statecraft and military power to accomplish our goals. And I think that is just depressingly vague and abstract public discourse on these issues that can't really lead us anywhere good.
Well, thank you so much, guys, for coming on.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Okay.